Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Joe Biden is the president-elect. The Trump campaign's legal challenges are failing. Yet those facts have not breached the impenetrable wall of grievance and conspiracy in the conservative media ecosystem.
This is Newsmax, where we have not called the election. Why would we? We do not know who has won. This whole idea of a president-elect, it is a media fabrication.
And over on Fox News, opinion hosts like Pete Hegseth continue to pound away.
And it is premature to declare that Joe Biden is the president-elect. We shall find out who the president-elect is when all the legal votes are counted.
Well, in fact, all the legal votes have been counted, and in some states, they've been counted again. Wisconsin is doing its recount right now, and nowhere is there any evidence of widespread voter fraud. In fact, courts have found the Trump administration's claims to be without merit. Not that this would be a point of discussion amongst Fox News opinion hosts, but this weekend, a Pennsylvania judge ruled that the Trump campaign's attempts to throw out almost 7 million votes was so strained and, quote, lacking in merit and unsupported by evidence that, quote, the judge said, in the United States of America, this cannot justify the disenfranchisement of a single voter, let alone all the voters of its sixth most populous state. Well, no matter, because One America News Network instead focused this weekend on Michigan and juiced an unfounded conspiracy theory about voting machines.
When a single county in Michigan switched votes from Trump to Biden, that was the difference between a Biden victory and a Trump victory. Dominion voting systems, Democrats, and the media all insist this was a one-time error. Do you believe them?
Well, again, in fact, the Michigan Secretary of State released a detailed account of what happened in that one county and found that problems were a result of human error and, quote, did not affect the way ballots were actually tabulated. But those facts don't really matter, Matthew Sheffield, do they? Because I think the most important word in that One America News Network clip we just played is believe. And Matthew, do far-right media simply dwell in a world that's uniquely defined by belief?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate characterization. Thanks for having me. In essence, the Republican Party and the conservative movement has spent 50 years creating an alternative reality where their leaders are never wrong and everybody else is a liar and not to be trusted.
And you, your professional history, you identify as having been a part of that of that system, right? As someone who helped build conservative media into what it is today. You began your career as a right-wing blogger. You want to tell me about your role in all of this?
Sure. Well, so I was raised in a very ultra-Orthodox Mormon family, and we, for whatever reason, our family watched the CBS Evening News. My parents did in the 90s, and one of my brothers and I decided that we didn't like their coverage of Bill Clinton's impeachment, and so we started up a website about Dan Rather called ratherbias.com, and that kind of just exploded in popularity. And after that, we launched the website newsbusters.org with a group called the Media Research Center. And by that time, I had left Mormonism. And I thought that I could perhaps bring in, sort of expand the tent of conservatism in the United States to include secular people, to include Muslims, you know, Jewish people. And so that was sort of my goal, to try to help people on the right understand media better and be better about media. But ultimately, I realized that that was a fool's errand. And anyway, a few years later, after starting Newsbusters, I was the first online managing editor of the Washington Examiner, which is one of the most popular conservative news sites today. And I was involved with several other ones as well.
So this is why your perspective is particularly valuable, Matthew. I should say you're host of the Theory of Change podcast now and working on a memoir about growing up in your Mormon family. But I can't imagine it was any one particular thing, but what is it that sort of drew you out of the fog and into this different way of viewing conservative or right-wing media in this country? Was there one event in particular, or how did you get to where you are now in being such a critic of it?
Yeah, well, you're right. There wasn't any particular single instance, but there were several. One was that I noticed that a lot of my colleagues in conservative media, they didn't seem to put in a lot of effort to respond to critiques made by progressives, liberals, centrists. They just kind of said whatever they believed. And so I thought that that was going to not be persuasive to people who were outside of our movement. So I started exploring left-wing media and, you know, mainstream press in depth. And, you know, I became increasingly concerned that the people on my side didn't know what they were talking about. I think the first one for me was the idea that many conservatives believe that if you cut taxes, that the government will have more revenue. And even by their own theory of supply side economics, it doesn't even make sense, because according to supply side theory, there is a sort of maximum point of where the tax cuts don't bring in revenue anymore. But they don't even know their own theory. And so that was very concerning to me. And then one of the other things that was concerning to me was that in 2012, as I had, you know, become sort of wary that conservatives didn't understand politics or didn't understand how many people didn't really believe in slashing the government the way that my colleagues did, I started writing a book, and I had a major publisher. I wrote 80,000 words of it, and I started showing it to some of my clients and coworkers. And one of the points in the book was that, you know, America is becoming the biggest demographic change in this country is the growth of secularization. So people who don't believe in the religion that they were raised in. And that is something that I said that conservatives have to make peace with and to accept secular people in their coalition. And I showed that part of the book to several colleagues who were, you know, more devout traditionalist Christians, and they hated that part. And some of them actually started trying to get me fired. From jobs, which is really ironic, because, you know, conservatives love to say that liberals have a cancel culture where they don't like where they try to censor opposing views. But I lived that, but it was conservatives who did it.
So let me ask you this: that those series of events then led you to where you are now, which is really speaking, quite frankly, from your personal experience as having been part of this system, of your deep concerns about right-wing media here. You actually had a pretty widespread Twitter thread earlier this month where you said that you see conservative-dominated media as being much more biased than left-wing media. And you make an important distinction here. You say that left-wing media lacks diversities, but they operate mostly in good faith, you said. But then you write that you realize that in right-wing media, they see their duty as being something else in particular. What do you see that they believe their duty is as media organizations?
Well, basically, so they don't see journalism the way that more traditional journalists do. They see what their media enterprise is as about activism and about supporting whoever their whoever is the top Republican. That's what they see as their duty. And so, like, and that's and later on in the show, one of our guests is going to talk about this more. But from the very beginning of conservative media in this country, it has been heavily linked to political electioneering. So. And that's continued down to this day that, you know, so many current right-wing media outlets were created by political organizations or people who had political motives. So, like, for instance, you know, you have the Washington Times newspaper, which is owned by a religious cult out of South Korea. You've got the Epoch Times, which is a new brand that's come along that's run by the Falun Gong cult out of China. You've got the Daily Wire, which is funded and owned by Ted Cruz's political benefactors. You've got townhall.com, which was started by the Heritage Foundation to promote its views. And you can just go down the list that on Daily Caller was funded by this billionaire who bankrolled Rick Santorum's presidential campaigns. So there's just not they have a completely different objective, both the funders and the writers and the producers.
Well, you said a second ago, though, that the for many of these right wing media outlets, their purpose, their reason for being is to support not just conservatism or the Republican Party, but the person who is the top Republican, that person. How different is that now from what it was? You know, you're looking at what you call like a 50-year horizon here, a time span.
Well, I get it's ultimately the sentiment hasn't changed all that much. It's just that the conservative movement so utterly dominates the Republican Party now. And Donald Trump is so, you know, authoritarian and has such tight control over his followers. So it's basically made it so that if you are an independent conservative who wants to criticize Trump, you can't have a business.
Matthew, hang on here for a second. We've just got to take a quick break. We'll hear a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking with Matthew Sheffield. He's host of the Theory of Change podcast, and he's a former conservative blogger and worked for a long time in conservative media in various outlets, including as founder of the right-leaning website Newsbusters. And over the past several years, he's spoke out rather clearly and distinctively about his concerns about that very conservative media ecosystem he was a part of for so long. And he joins us today from Washington. And Matthew, I just want to play really quickly a little taste of one of the most widely listened to conservative media figures in the United States. That's Rush Limbaugh. Just last week on his radio program, he claimed that former President Barack Obama stayed in Washington, D.C. after his term was over in order to undermine the Trump administration. That's what Rush claimed. In reality, Obama remained in D.C. in order for his youngest daughter to complete her high school education. But here's how Rush framed it.
He has been pulling all of the strings for the last 4 years on everything. Now, I said it would happen, but he did it under the radar. I thought he would do it publicly. Well, the truth is, the drive-bys allowed him to do it under this. They're deeply involved, too. They allowed him to do it under the radar. They took orders. It was Obama that was giving the media their marching orders. It was the media that permitted Obama to do all of this under the radar and anonymously.
That's Rush Limbaugh on his show last week. And again, President Obama in reality stayed in D.C. for his youngest daughter to finish her high school education. And Limbaugh said his source was Lee Smith at the Epoch Times, which Matthew Sheffield tells us or reminds us is an outlet funded by the Falun Gong from China. But Matthew, I just want to ask you quickly, in hearing that clip from Limbaugh, what exactly is he doing there that's so potent, that's so powerful in holding conservative listeners as closely as he does to this this worldview?
It's funny, Meghna. I actually had prepared another transcript from his show, Limbaugh's show, on Friday. So it's great that you provided that segue for me. So there's two things that are happening here from what Limbaugh is doing. One is that he's exemplifying that right-wing media figures, they're not journalists. They just simply believe anything that is negative about their political opponents, and they don't bother to fact check anything. They operate from the feeling that the left is evil, and so therefore anything that is negative about it is true. And so if he had spent even 5 minutes, he could have found that statement that he was saying wasn't true. But it doesn't matter, because even if it's a lie, it's still true, because liberals are the devil. So that's number one. And then number two is, on Friday, one of his callers called into his show and provided a perfect example of the effect that decades of listening to this propaganda has on Republican voters and conservative hardcore activists. I'm just going to read something that a caller said to him. He was talking about how he felt about the continued judicial fail, court rulings against the Trump campaign as they're trying to desperately cling to power. So I'm just going to read what this guy said. He's talking about liberals first. He said, "They should be afraid, very afraid. Trump and you," meaning Limbaugh, "are all we have left, Rush. No one stands for us, Rush, only you and Donald Trump. God forbid, what do we have left? I love my president. I am not a revolutionary, Rush, but I would die for my president. This man has given more to this country than anybody, and he has no need to, none. He's a billionaire. He doesn't need this." "That's exactly right," Limbaugh replied.
Okay. So, Matthew, hang on here for a second, because as you pointed out, we didn't just get here overnight. So I want to explore a little bit more about the forces that brought that came together over the past many decades that lead us to the kinds of calls and responses that you've just pointed to. So Nicole Hemmer joins us now from New York. Nicole's a political historian and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, and also co-host of the podcast This Day in Esoteric Political History. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
Okay, so start where Matthew just left us, with that relationship that you heard between the caller to Rush Limbaugh's show and the kind of content or things that Limbaugh himself has been saying for so many years. Is this are we in a distinctly different moment now than, say, we had been 40 or 50 years ago? Or even, we've done shows about conservative radio programs from the 1930s. Is this distinctly different or not?
It is distinctly different, but I think we have to understand that period from the 1930s on to understand how we got here. There was, as you were just saying, right-wing radio in the 1930s. There was a much more robust conservative media that was developed in the 1950s and 1960s. But at the time, it was powerful within conservatism. It was increasingly powerful within the Republican Party, but it didn't have this all-encompassing, almost cult-like following that it has now. And that change really happens when people like Rush Limbaugh and Fox News appear on the scene, and they bring, you know, not just conservative politics, but entertainment and this totalizing conservative media, where if you're a conservative today, you have no reason to interact with other media sources. You can listen to 24 hours of talk radio or a podcast, or now you can choose from a number of different conservative cable news outlets. There's a totality to it that we haven't seen before.
And what drove that?
A lot of political incentives. Conservative media turned out to be really powerful. I mean, we saw this as early as the early 1990s when President George H.W. Bush saw how popular Rush Limbaugh was and was so concerned about his political fortunes that he invited Rush Limbaugh and his television producer Roger Ailes to the White House. And in that way, empowered Limbaugh to at least be seen as a kingmaker, as somebody who controlled these millions of listeners and that therefore millions of voters who clung to his every word. And that sort of entwinement of the Republican Party and conservative media and those millions of conservatives who are loyal and constant voters, those three things together have created this sort of political juggernaut that's transformed American politics.
You know, you heard Matthew earlier say that you also now can't have a business. He sees it as you can't even do business in media as a conservative unless there's this particular type of content that you're putting out. How much is the money or the business aspect of this part of the story?
Oh, it's a huge part of the story. And that's the big change that happens when Rush Limbaugh and Fox News appear on the scene, because those folks in the 30s and 40s and 50s weren't making any money. So you add in this financial incentive and suddenly things start to look different. And we saw this so clearly when Donald Trump took over the Republican Party, because you see people who were diehard conservatives, but who were also anti-Trump, begin to lose their jobs. We see the Weekly Standard shut down. We see radio hosts get fired. We see Fox News reshuffling its lineup in order to align with President Trump. And so the economics matter a lot, and where the economics meet the politics. They know that audiences want a certain kind of content, and they change their content in order to meet where the base is.
Well, one more question, then Matthew, I'll turn back to you here. But there, you know, you heard Matthew earlier, and I'm sure you've seen in his writing, that he's making a really clear assertion about what he sees as the big difference, or one of the major differences between right-wing and left-wing, or conservative and liberal. I'm not even actually sure what the right labels are, to be perfectly honest. But and that is this actually just belief in what the basics of journalism are. Like what's the duty? Is the duty to report facts, or is the duty, as Matthew said, to shape stories that are in the service of the head of the Republican Party? I mean, are the differences as clear and absolute as that? I mean, because we talk a lot about, you know, parallel universes. This isn't even like a parallelism we're talking about.
That's exactly right. I mean, I don't think that we should equate conservative and liberal media, right-wing and left-wing media, because they come from very different places. This conservative media that we're talking about, and this is why the history is really important, was founded in order to move a particular political project. People like William F. Buckley and Clarence Mannion, who were working in the 1950s, were using media because they believed communications was key to changing politics in America. And that sort of core political mission drove conservatives in the 1950s and 60s, and it drives conservatives in media today. And that's just so different from what we see elsewhere in the media landscape. And when we see a little bit of that on the left, I think there's some growth in that on the left, it doesn't have the same kind of power. You don't see Democrats quavering in fear whenever Rachel Maddow says something. But you do see that when Rush Limbaugh attacks.
Matthew, you want to jump in here? What's your response to what Nicole's saying?
I think that's exactly right. And Yeah, and what's the, I mean, there are just so many examples. The conservative website Red State, they fired several people because they were too anti-Trump, and several people resigned after their posts were censored. And in my own experience, when I was at Washington Examiner as the first online managing editor, I had tried to push for a more balanced columnist selection because I thought that, you know, so I was living in D.C. at the time, and D.C. is one of the most heavily Democratic metro areas in the country. And they were trying to have a print newspaper targeting that market. And I said, you know, wouldn't it make sense to have a selection of columnists that was balanced, that we would have some conservative ones and some progressive ones? And they said, no, they didn't want to do that. They would never do that. And, you know, to me, that was, they see it as a mission rather than a profit-making enterprise, the way that mainstream media operates.
Mm. So, Nicole, you're talking about the view of the importance of political communication to advance ideas or particular sets of politics. Look, the complete divorce from facts that a lot of these media outlets sustain is appalling. I just want to say that. I think that we need to have a common set of facts as a nation in order to have any kind of beneficial conversation across viewpoints. So that's, I think that just should be said here. And at the same time, I imagine that there are folks listening to this who might, you know, listen to or watch some of the shows that we've been talking about and would say, well, the idea of using communication to advance political ideas is as old as America. I mean, Thomas Paine and his pamphleteers and his pamphlets. So, like, what is measurably different and worse now than this tradition in America?
That is absolutely right. And that is a tradition that conservatives speak into. So in the 1950s, as they're ramping up these new media enterprises, they say, we are the pamphleteers, we are the Thomas Paines, we're the William Lloyd Garrisons who are using media the way Americans always have in order to affect political change. I think that the big difference is, you know, there's an epistemological divide here. And this gets to your point about the detachment from facts. What you see in the conservative media that develops over the course of the past 60 years or so is that it's a different way of thinking about information, and it's a different set of authorities. The way that conservatives have learned to assess whether an outlet is trustworthy is its ideology, not necessarily its reflection of reality. So the first thing you do is you check, is this right-wing? Is this right-wing enough? Is this the right kind of conservatism? And that's how you decide whether you can trust it, not whether it hews to a certain reality or a set of facts. And that's just an entirely different way of considering and consuming media than what we generally see in politics in the United States. So that's the big difference.
And do you see the momentum around this really heading in one direction, or can it be? I don't know if contained is the right word, but can facts become part of conservative or right wing media once again, or is the trajectory just in one way?
So there certainly are some efforts to try to do that. A lot of the anti-Trump conservatives have sought to find a place where there can be a kind of fact-rooted or reporting-rooted conservative media. But the flow or all of the energy is moving in a different direction. I mean, this is something that has happened time again. Daily Caller was founded in order to ostensibly to be a place where conservative media was based more in reporting, and it's moved so far away from that. And so even as you have these activists trying to move back toward some sort of more deeply rooted in fact or journalistic practice kind of media, they're moving against incredibly strong headwinds. What you see across the board in conservative media is this real propulsion toward in the same direction it's been going for a while. And why not? It has worked pretty well for them politically for years now. So until there are actual serious political consequences again and again and again and again, until this is no longer an effective route to political power, it's going to continue to move in that direction.
And how is that going to happen, though, if there's this hermetically sealed loop, right, between the consumers of this media, perhaps how they vote, the money, and the media outlets themselves? I mean, they are, it's like they're operating in their own perpetual motion machine.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a happy picture, and I don't have an optimistic or easy plan for getting out of it, because it's not just about media, right? It's bound up in a rejection of democracy that we're seeing right now, and that only exacerbates the problem. It doesn't offer a lot of great solutions.
Well, Nicole Hemmer is a political historian and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics, and co-host of the podcast This Day in Esoteric Political History. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Matthew, hang on here for a second. When we come back from the other side of the break, I do actually want to hear from you about solutions. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about polling and election 2020. Yeah, the polls were off in some places and off significantly. So we're going to take a look at how polling is supposed to be done. Ideally, how is it supposed to work? And we want to hear from you. Do you trust polling after the 2016 and 2020 elections? And how about this? We want to push this forward a little bit. What are the better ways, if not polling, what are the better ways of measuring public opinion and sentiment on really important issues in this country? Tell us your story and your ideas at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking with Matthew Sheffield. He's host of the Theory of Change podcast. He spent a lot of his professional career in the conservative media universe, including as founder of the right-leaning website Newsbusters. And he has since become a prominent critic of conservative and right-wing media and of the effect that it's having, not on just on the people who consume it, but on this country. And we actually heard from a lot of listeners about this as well. Here is Roger from Lincoln, Nebraska.
It really is scary to me how we have two different universes in our country. And it's hard for me to believe that it'll ever change unless the media changes.
Well, joining us now is Eliana Johnson. She's editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon, former White House correspondent for Politico, and has worked at other news outlets as well. Eliana, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be with you.
So first of all, give us your response to Matthew's core concerns and criticisms of conservative media. What do you think about what he's been saying?
You know, in listening to both Matthew and Nicole, I think what they said just isn't reflective of my experience in conservative media. Granted, I have not had personal experience with many of the organizations they cited, but I have. I was the Washington editor at National Review. I have worked at Fox News, and I'm now running a conservative website. You know, I go to National Review today. I see criticisms of Trump. I think Matthew said that you have to, if you're a conservative doing media, you have to believe that their leaders are never wrong and everybody else is a liar. And can't be trusted. I think there's been a lot of hand-wringing about Trump on the right, and I fear that the discussion that you all just had falls into caricaturing one's ideological opponents rather than grappling with what they have to say and taking them seriously, which is what I've always tried to do.
Mm. And so this is an important point, because the same broad brush is frequently painted across all quote-unquote mainstream media or liberal media. I think anyone who talks about the media likes to use the broadest brush possible. So let's narrow it. Let's have a finer, a more granular sense of detail here. Would you say that currently, as editor in chief of the Washington Free Beacon and some of the other places that you work for, is that do they have the same fealty to fundamental tenets of journalism as the rest of media, and that makes them distinctly different than, say, Newsmax or One America News Network or Rush and the titans of right wing talk radio?
It's a good question. At National Review, I certainly think that's the case, and I was able to seamlessly transition from there to Politico, which I think is a similarly rigorous reportorial organization. National Review also does opinion, so they do plenty of things that aren't reported. But certainly, in their approach to reporting, it was rigorous, and the place has produced many of the media's top reporters, from Robert Costa at PBS to Tim Alberta, my colleague at Politico and at National Review, and Commentary Magazine, also an opinion outlet, plenty critical of Trump. This isn't to say that there are outlets that brook no criticism of the president. Certainly Fox falls more on that spectrum. But I think it's a mistake to throw all conservative media in a single basket.
Matthew, you want to respond to that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I definitely would agree that National Review is more rigorous than a lot of more further right media outlets. I think that's true also of the Washington Times newspaper. But the reality is that those outlets they're just not popular with the conservative voters. And just as a, for instance, there is a far right website called The Daily Stormer. They were forced off of the mainstream internet for a while, but for a long time, they were on the regular internet, and they actually had more readers on their site than the Weekly Standard did. And that says something. But it's not just that, neo-Nazis, but like InfoWars, Alex Jones. Alex Jones has more traffic on his website than almost any conservative website. And if you go back to the 2016 election, before Facebook started cracking down on misleading content, then they still have a lot to do in that regard. But in 2016, there were several far right Facebook pages that were more popular on Facebook than Fox News was. So you had the conspiracy website Gateway Pundit. You had a fake news website called Western Journalism. And you had other ones that they were just killing Fox News on Facebook. Breitbart was more popular than them. And so, yes, it's absolutely true that there are people on the right who don't buy into this cultic mentality. But it's very hard financially to exist in that world. And I personally know several people who have been have had their careers harmed because they wouldn't toe the line in conservative journalism. I've had somebody who had to change his blogging name because he had been very anti-Trump and continued to be so, and people would not hire him to write articles. And so he started having a pen name instead and wasn't so anti-Trump, and that solved the problem for him.
Well, Eliana, I don't think we should paint any group of people or organizations with a broad brush. So to that point, though, all media is competing for attention, eyeballs, ears. Does Does the Washington Free Beacon have the reach or engagement that some of the far right outlets that Matthew just quoted seem to have?
The easy answer would be no. I think the more complicated answer is that traffic to a website is but one metric by which to measure its influence. And going back to National Review, you know, William F. Buckley Jr., the founder, said, "The place exists to make a point, not a profit." The place has really never turned a profit. But I think you would be hard pressed to say that even though, 40% of the country is not leafing through National Review, that it's not influential. And I think intellectual influence is something different from traffic to conspiracy websites, which, because they are trash, you know, People Magazine is always going to have more readers than an intellectual journal. But that's not to say it's more influential.
Hmm. So,
well, but people,
go ahead, Matthew.
But
no,
People
please.
Magazine is not accusing people of murder the way that Alex Jones does every day. I mean, Alex Jones has literally called for people to be executed. And he is an integral figure to this Stop the Steal movement that has just taken over the far right social media world. I mean, him and Roger Stone the Proud Boys, like, they're all there and they're mixing it up with the Trump supporters, and everybody seems to be fine with it who goes to these rallies. Alex Jones is the leader at many of these rallies. It's really disgusting.
Elliot. I mean, I guess my question is, you know, what exactly does that have to do with me? You know, I don't approve of Alex Jones. I run a conservative website. You know, his claims concern me. But there was a point made earlier that that I don't think that we're grappling with, is that there was an argument made that this change has all happened because Rush and Fox News appeared on the scene. And I think it's a real chicken or the egg question. You know, why did Fox News appear on the scene, and why did Rush find some success? You know, the late conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer said that Fox found an audience in 50% of the country. And when I look at it, I think that the mainstream media's primary problem is a loss of trust with people. You know, there was some talk about Dan Rather. He's a great example of that, you know, resigned from CBS in disgrace. But also, I think, a lack of accountability. The polls were wrong, and that's all we've been hearing from the mainstream for the past year. I believed it. I thought Republicans would be wiped out in this election. And I think I do think that the mainstream bears a fair amount of fault for losing the trust of Americans.
So I just want to make a quick point here, because Eliana, I want to acknowledge that you're kind of in an interesting position in the context of this show, because we did not invite Rush Limbaugh. We did not reach out to Dan Bonijo, for example. We did not reach out to the Daily Stormer, because I did not want to have to spend an hour rebunking lie after lie, or debunking, I should say, lie after lie after lie. That was not going to be the purpose of this program. So, you know, maybe that would have been a better way to do this. And so I am not equating what you're doing with them. I just want to acknowledge that. So you've been put in a slightly difficult position here. But I guess the question I want to ask you is, you were talking about intellectual influence. And I think that's a really important thing I want to explore with you for one second here, because I would push back against the assertion that attention and eyeballs isn't really a good measure when it comes to measuring intellectual influence, because we're having this conversation because of the direction that the Republican Party in the whole is going, or how voters did vote. So, like, you can be doing journalism at the Washington Free Beacon from a conservative viewpoint that's still anchored in fact, but if it's not actually reaching or having an impact or penetrating that wall of grievance and conspiracy theory that seems to have been built up around so many Americans, I mean, how do you face that challenge? You don't have – do you want to have the same kind of influence? And can you, while also adhering to the precepts of good journalism?
I do think you can. And my point wasn't that, you know, traffic or eyeballs doesn't matter. Of course it does. But it's just one measure of influence. And I think the Beacon is not the most highest traffic website out there. Nonetheless, in 2016, the Beacon stories on Hillary Clinton's private diaries and tapes were enormously influential. And I'll bet that most people heard about those stories in the mainstream, and they didn't register as traffic on the Beacon's website. Some of our reporting on Elizabeth Warren and the primary, similar. because the currents of information are sort of like throwing a rock in a pond. They have a much wider effect than they ripple out.
Well, Eliana Johnson is editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon. Eliana, thank you so much for coming on the show
today. Thank you. Yeah.
So, Matthew, we've got about 4 minutes left, and I just wanted to – I should have saved more time for this. But my question to you is, what do you think needs to be done? I mean, is there a way regarding those far right-wing media outlets and their influence, how to penetrate that wall of grievance, as I talked about, how to reduce their influence if they're peddling lies and conspiracy theories so successfully?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely, I think, one of the most important questions in this country today that you just asked. And I think the first step is to understand that the political organizing principle within the Republican Party has been for the past 60 years or so, the idea that so-and-so is a fake conservative, this person who came before me, they're a rhino Republican in name only. And I am the true conservative. I'm further to the right than them. That has led to this cycle of increasing radicalization. And it's what makes it hard for more mainstream and fact-based conservatives to exist and have popularity and influence. And so ultimately, the people who have been funding the Republican Party, you know, the Christian nationalist billionaires and the Ayn Rand fan billionaires, they need to understand that they've created a system that is, you know, not very different from the Communist Party in the USSR. Like they had basically created this system where they could turn on a dime from attacking Hitler. The Hitler-Stalin pact, where they just turned on a dime before Hitler was evil and terrible, but then they signed the treaty and then they made everybody else have to turn on a dime and say that, well, you know what, Hitler maybe is not so bad. And early conservatism was formed as a reaction and a response and a copying of some of these radical communist techniques. And so we have to understand where it's coming from. And then the other thing is that ultimately, probably the best solution is that we need to have tighter libel laws in this country, because right now under the case law, public figures are they don't have a lot of the protections that people who are private or unknown people have. And that's not how a lot of other countries do their media. And if you look at this country compared to other countries where they do have tighter libel laws, they don't have nearly as much of a problem with misinformation as we do here in America.
So changing the law, you think, would have that much of an effect? I feel like there's something also deeper involved. I mean, there's a whole worldview here.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, and that's the thing. That's the first part is that the funders of the right-wing media, they need to face consequences, social business consequences for what they do. Rupert Murdoch, it has been enabling, you know, a growth of a fanatical movement in this country. And anybody who is funding these far-right publications needs to be exposed, and they need to stop funding it. And they need to start funding mainstream Republicans like Larry Hogan. And they need to actively counter, because otherwise, there's just going to go radicalization over and over and get worse and worse.
Well, Matthew Sheffield is host of the Theory of Change podcast and a former member of the conservative media ecosystem that he's now working hard to change, as you've heard. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Agnetha Chakrabarty. This is On Point.